You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Episode 9, Land of Canaan. On today's episode, we have special guest Kanan Flowers, indie editor for Film and Video, host of That Post Show and Scruffy Thinking, also the creator of Jake Forgotten, a feature-length film currently in post-production. Did you ever re-ingest all that footage?
Yeah, it was, 76 hours of my life to get all of the footage back into a state where I could use it.
Oof. Nice.
So like more than just, you know, an afternoon then.
Yeah, exactly. The problem, you know, I'm forgetting who I talked about this with on one of my shows because it all blurs together as one sort of soupy, you know, jumble of words with me making long, slow pauses where someone could literally drive a truck through the time between words. But I was talking about the difference between tape-based acquisition and the sort of newfangled acquisition that people do. And the nice thing about tape is you have an archive, which is great. But the crappy thing about tape is you know, it's a one-to-one, right? You shoot an hour, you wait an hour to ingest, and if anything goes wrong, you have to do something else, right?
Right.
Start over, figure it out. I mean, I've had problems, of course, not on Jake, but I've had problems on other shows where the tape, I would get macro blocking because it's tape, right? It's an imperfect magnetic media. Mm-hmm. And so it's just such a nightmare. But then I've also heard people talk about how they, for a while there, they were shooting on compact flash on the red. And then if you didn't use the red, the compact flash cards that said red on them, they were having actual corrupt files where the whole file wouldn't be corrupt, but some part of it would be during red code, transcode.
Right. Yeah.
So it's not all perfect, but I'll tell you, there's something really nice about grabbing a 64 gig flash card, popping it into something, and just hitting import, and then 8 minutes later, you have this giant amount of footage, right,
well,
that you can start transcoding.
Well, I mean, it's really just a file copy at that point, which is fantastic, because the tape is only going to be fed into the system in real time.
Right.
But then we become Homer Simpson. It's like, 10 seconds, I want it now.
Is there anything faster than a microwave?
The thing that sucks about tape, though, and I've always thought this, is it's not just the tape that's a total pain in the ass. It's like you're going through all of these levels of abstraction, right? Because it's compressed onto the tape. And then you have a deck. And then the deck has some kind of output. And that output sends it in some kind of 422 8-bit compressed weird codec over FireWire or whatever you're doing. I mean, you can never really get that kind of pristine, gorgeous footage that you shot if you have a tape. And the only way to do that is when you're shooting to go, let's say, uncompressed HDMI out through some kind of AJA IO or AJA IO or AJA or however the hell people say it, through a Blackmagic intensity card and, you know, and acquire it as uncompressed 444. But boy, if you don't do that in the beginning and have copious amounts of drive space, you're just kind of sitting there staring at something that's been YouTube stomped on. It's really painful. So yeah, I shot a whole fucking film on that crap.
Right.
At 720p, 24 frames a second. Genius.
My nice. Understanding is you gave people other people cameras too.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Have all that crap too. Good job.
Yeah, so
really happy you did that.
Yeah. I was like, oh, you know what'll be great? Instead of setting this up multiple times with one camera, we'll do a 3 or 4 camera shoot. You know, constantly rolling. And I'll give somebody a fucking Canon XL1, you know, and they can do behind the scenes. And sometimes they'll put that in 16:9 mode, and sometimes they'll put it in 4:3 mode.
Randomly.
It'll be fun.
Oh, good.
Because I'll never have to re-import this stuff again.
Right.
No, well,
exactly. And so, you know.
Inside baseball we're leaving off for some of the listeners is what happened. Can you like tell us briefly what happened to the Jake Forgotten footage?
Oh yeah, that's a real treasure of a story that makes me sound competent. So I had the original tapes, they were stored, everything was fine. And they were stored in a secure place where they weren't going to get lost and they weren't going to get damaged and there was not going to be a fire hazard. You know, it was fine. So I knew I had the original, much like Star Trek has all the original, right. I guess, film in this case. You know, in a salt mine. I didn't have it in a salt mine, but I had it in a place that was equally secure. For those who don't know, there are places like Iron Mountain where you can send them something and they will store it in a way inside of a mountain. So it was stored in a place like that.
That's who does my backups too.
You mean...
There you go.
Ben Durbin's house?
Yeah. I trust Ben Durbin with my life. I'm telling you, if there was a fire, he would, you know, forget the wife and kid. He would go straight for the tapes of Jake Forgotten. That's just how important that fucking thing is to, you know, anyway.
He's a good guy. Yeah.
He's a good guy. Yep. And so stored in a secure facility with armed guards, it was fine. But I had all of the I have all of those tapes ingested and edited and everything on a hard drive, I think it was a 2 terabyte external hard drive. And I was going through, well, I actually went into Mexico and I kept telling myself, I'm going to totally send this to Amazon and they're going to copy it to Amazon S3 and I'll just have it stored at Amazon. Because I don't know if we've talked about this or you've talked about this, but Amazon does this really cool thing where for like $100, they will copy the contents of a hard drive onto S3 storage so that you don't have to upload it. And that really matters when you're talking about multiple terabytes.
I was going to say, it's a hell of a lot more convenient than doing it via your cable modem.
Right. Even no matter how fast it is, right? Because 2 terabytes upload takes a long time. I mean, even on Fios, it's pretty, you know, you're talking about days. Best case scenario. Worst case scenario, you're talking about months. If you had, for example, Comcast or, as I found, AT&T, which has unlimited bandwidth that's limited to 200 gigabytes a month, and then they throttle you. So unlike Comcast and AT&T, Amazon recognizes that the world is not a perfect place and that you might have to actually send something to them and they might actually have to copy it, you know, sneaker net it across almost. And so anyway, you can send the drive to them. So I had it all set up. I was going to send the drive. I had it like ready to be mailed to Amazon in my backpack. I'm in Mexico, and sometime around Cabo San Lucas, I forgot that it was in my backpack. I don't know how this transpired. Maybe I was delirious from the water. I mean, I did have food poisoning in La Paz and was sick for 48 hours.
Yeah.
So maybe in a fever state, I thought that I'd sent it, but I had not. And so I got to Zipolite, and then while in Zipolite, I was in a cabana and somebody pushed open the wooden window with a stick, grabbed a bag, which just happened to be a bag with the footage, a Kindle, and an iPod Touch. Like literally the only technology I had the whole time we were traveling. And then absconded with it.
The thing I like most about that story, not that it's a good story, is it sounds like something out of a James Bond movie. I can see the window slowly moving open in the moonlight.
Right.
Meanwhile, Blofeld and crazy people with iron jaws and such.
Yeah, so I lost everything. I mean, luckily, you know, I had a backup of the Final Cut Pro project file. And the Final Cut Pro project file, combined with acquiring all of the media again when I came back, made it somewhat close to the edit that I originally did.
Yeah. Again, The problem with tape, nothing ever lines up perfectly.
Yeah, and the audio was out of sync by 16 frames, and the certain pieces of the audio were just not quite there. And you know, there were entire scenes that were shifted by 2 or 3 minutes because the tape, I don't know. So I was using an HD BR50, which is it's actually an HD BR50U from JVC, which is unfortunately the only deck on the fucking planet that can read JVC's Pro HD format. For a long time, well, not a long time, but for about a year and a half there, JVC had these cameras called the GY series. I don't know if you remember these. They had like the GY100, and they all shot 720p, and they had these amazing Fujinon lenses, and everybody thought they were going to be the future. And then, of course, the future arrived, and it wasn't them. But they had this one deck, this HD BR50U or whatever, that could capture this shit. And I'm not going to say that the deck was designed by monkeys because I don't want to insult monkeys, because they can actually learn how to sign. And this deck could not possibly have been designed by them, because that would require an intelligence that just does not exist in the designers of this deck. It is flaky as fuck as a deck. It's like, the FireWire goes out constantly. Like, you can ask anybody who owns it. Half the time it doesn't work. Half the time it doesn't acquire. There are fucking flip switches on the front of it, like an Altar 8800 fucking system. It is insane to get it to work.
So it's not just your version. It's all of them.
Every single one of them. Which is why they came out with the 50U, because the 50 was such a colossal piece of crap that nobody... I mean, it was so unusable. The 50U was the upgrade, you know, it was the better one. And it was still just heinous and painful. But anyway, they did the smartest thing that, you know, anyone could ever do, and by that I mean the dumbest, which was they tried to auto detect scene changes and reset time code during ingest during Oh, yeah. And the camera tried to do that, too. So we always had the cameras. We used to do this thing where we would, you could set the camera to roll back 10 seconds. So we would always overshoot by like 30 seconds, 40 seconds, and then let the camera auto roll back to 10 so that we would overwrite some of our own footage so that the time code wouldn't get reset on the camera.
Right. Oh, geez. That's awful.
And then still, it didn't matter because the stupid deck designed by imbeciles still tried to reset time code during ingest. And it did this in Premiere and Final Cut 7 and Avid and Final Cut Pro 10 had the same problem. Like, I just could not find software that wouldn't reset the time code. So now you're doing a three-camera shoot. You're syncing with, you know, you're doing in-camera audio on most of them. You know, you're doing time code sync, though, right?
Because
you're resetting the time code and you have a, you know, a slate. And but so anyway, I ended up having to go back through and just, obviously, nothing synced up quite right because it didn't quite do it the same way every time. It reset the time code in some places and not others. So one time you would have a 60-minute long piece of footage, and another time you would have 17 pieces of footage, each of them with reset time code.
And you were doing, but you were doing in-camera audio for all the cameras or just one master camera?
I was doing in-camera audio for all the cameras for reference audio, and then the actual audio itself was captured to a field recorder. I would say 90% of the audio was captured in an external device, and then the cameras themselves were just used for sync.
Right, so you could show it in like a pluralize or
as I learned this morning, Final Cut Pro 10 10.0.3
does multicam.
And not only does multicam, it like rocks the house at multicam because it auto syncs based on audio cues.
I was playing around with it when the announcement came down. I immediately downloaded it and started playing with it, and I was like, this is easily the best multicam I've ever seen. You know, you bring up the array of different scenes, and you pretty much just point to the one you want, and then that becomes your cue, which is very, very cool.
Well, you guys stop talking nice about Final Cut Pro 10. I'm still mad at him.
Well, to be fair, the broadcast monitor output sucks.
Well, didn't they say it was...
Well, how can I describe this in a way that's not offensive?
Donkey balls?
I was going to say something even more vulgar.
Oh.
Oh, please do.
Go with it.
I want to be impressed.
Really?
Oh, yes.
So broadcast monitoring support on Final Cut Pro 10 right now sucks. And we're going to cut that.
Oh, hell yes, we're cutting that out in post.
Is there a beyond explicit tag?
But to their credit, I mean, they did say that monitor out is in beta for whatever that means. I mean, clearly beta means it doesn't work, but we wanted to give it to you anyway.
So it can say
there's beta. There's
there.
Like, you know, yeah, like Google Plus is beta, right? There's beta.
Yeah.
And I've used beta software.
Sure.
This is not beta. This is frame dropping, totally inaccurate, loses sync, absolutely unwatchable. You feel like you've wasted the hardware that you own.
Oof.
Because it just doesn't, you cannot maintain sync. I mean, skimming is a freaking nightmare. I mean, it jumps all over the place. It is not beta. It is not really alpha. It is unstable, unusable, embarrassing, bad.
And that's one of the other things, too. It's like, you know, okay, call it beta. I mean, at least they didn't say, yeah, this totally works fine and have it not work. But if something is that bad, just hold on to it until .4. Yes, we all want it, but if it's not usable, then we can't have it now, can we?
Well, right. Quite frankly, they didn't do that with 10.0, so they're not going to do it with 10.0.3.
Oh, I was actually going to say exactly the opposite. I was going to say that they released 10.0 without any features that we wanted.
Right, well, but...
And then progressively and slowly started rolling them out over the course of, what has it been now? 7-8 months?
I was going to say, slightly over half a year. It was actually November of... No. It was November was when they did the .2 or whatever.
Right.
Well, my point being that 10.0 wasn't ready when they shipped it.
No, not at all.
Well, it wasn't a complete...
At least it was functional, right, Maggie.
What was there functioned, right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. It wasn't ready.
Well, it wasn't complete. You know, it clearly was missing major features that were required for a pro video workflow that assumed multiple people, multiple rows, multiple bays.
I think John Foster summed it up best when he said, and don't get me wrong, I like the guys that make this product, but Foster was saying that he thought it was embarrassing that, you know, somebody created a third-party utility that lets you go from Final Cut Pro to Final Cut 10 Final Cut Pro 7 to Final Cut Pro 10.
Yeah.
And that 7X. People are cheering. Yeah, people are cheering. Yay! It's like, no.
It's like, yeah. Shouldn't Apple have done that for you?
Yeah, so I was just tweeting with this with Mike Nichols. It was like, you know, they were joking about something, and, you know, about, and then the page for 10.0.3 down at the bottom is a little blurb for 7X, which is that app that someone else wrote. And it's like, oh, here's a thing you can buy for the thing that we didn't put in.
Right. And then there's a companion one. There's a companion one that doesn't reverse.
Right.
So there's an X to 7 and then a 7 to X as well. And yeah, it just seems like, well, couldn't you just incorporate that into your application? What, you know, is there some sort of weird purity scale that they're, you know, that they just don't want to do? Same thing with EDL, right? I mean, they've increased their XML to, I guess they're calling it 1.1, which is a little, you know, whatever that means.
Yeah, you need to explain that to me. I saw that too. Now with XML 1.1, and I'm like, when did we version XML?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like,
I'm confused.
More niacin, more thiamin.
Yes. Right. It just seems really strange to me, because XML is defined by its data dictionary. And Apple controls that data dictionary. They still don't allow it to do the basic thing that everyone wants it to do, which is basically figure out how to translate to an EDL, or to do things like opacity. You know, it now has new audio cues, it now has a bunch of other stuff in it that it didn't have prior, but it still doesn't have basic, you know, the basic things as well. So it's still missing opacity, for one.
It's extend and embrace later.
So we were talking a little bit, you know, we got in the weeds there, but we were talking about video production, and really I was just curious, what made you do Jake Forgotten? What made you get into the whole indie filmmaking thing?
Well, I mean, I always loved film, and I remember being inspired as a kid by films. I remember sneaking out and going and see films like St. Elmo's Fire and, you know, The Breakfast Club and all of those films that you saw if you were
of a certain age.
A latchkey kid of the 80s.
And incredibly in love with Molly Ringwald, yes.
You know, so you watch shows like that, and you thought, oh, well, this is really good. This is a really nice thing. This is really great. And then over time, you experience something like I did. You experience something like The Godfather or Eight and a Half, by Fellini, mm-hmm. or these films that are seminal films that you had no exposure to as a latchkey kid in the 80s, right? You had exposure to all of these sort of ridiculous films, right?
Right.
And then you get exposure to all these films, and then you just go, my God, there's actually a way to tell a compelling story here that can impact someone. And for me, the thing that really, really happened was the late 90s, when Final Cut Pro came out, and I realized that the convergence of filmmaking and technology was starting to happen. And I started looking at it, and I said, I wonder if I can do that. And I got myself on a project, and I knew a lot about technology, and suddenly all of these things like frame rates and bit depth and, you know, all of these weird numbers that people were having trouble with, to me, were like, oh, well, I'm a technologist, so I'm used to big indie and little indie, and I'm used to, you know, 8-bit versus 16-bit versus 24-bit with a reserve for 32 total. And I just, these things were normal to me. They didn't seem weird. In fact, they seemed kind of trivial compared to the problems I'd been having writing code to deconstruct TCP/IP packets. So I really thought, oh my God, that technology expertise could be applied in a way that would allow me to do something I really want to do, which is get into film and get excited about this whole filmmaking thing. So I dinked around for a while and played with film and did a bunch of short films, and then started building myself out as a... I got into Shake and started doing node-based compositing, and it made a lot of sense to me. And then I started doing freelance because I was apparently good at it, and got on some films. And then sometime around 2004, I wrote a screenplay, which I sold, which was cool. Well, actually, I optioned. I didn't sell it. And it never got made. And then by the time 2007 rolled around, I'd had this book that I'd written called Jake Forgotten. And I thought, why am I letting somebody else control my destiny? I wrote this thing. I know a lot about film. I know a lot about what it takes to make a good film. Why don't I just try my hand at this? You know, I was going to say Robert Rodriguez style, but then I realized that sounds sort of arrogant. But I mean Robert Rodriguez in the, like, sold myself to science, medical experiment, let me see if I can make a $7,000 film way, right?
Sure.
So I did, and then I was anal retentive and never liked any of the cuts, and I just keep going, and someday I might actually put this thing in a place where I actually release it, which Hopefully that someday is this year.
Oh, right on. So you basically have all the edits done, and now that you've re-ingested because you were able to save the project file. So it's really just a matter of tweaking things, making sure things are, you know, as you wanted them, and then I guess finishing.
Right. Well, so the other thing that I did, though, is I re-ingested everything, I looked at it, and then I decided that I absolutely despised the last cut that I did, and it didn't tell the story in the way that I wanted. So I pulled it into Avid and completely recut the entire film.
From start to finish?
From start to finish. To tell a different story. And one of the things I did is I threw the script away. Well, I didn't throw it away, but I put it aside and started watching every piece of footage and asking myself, what is the real story here? Ignore the script. What is this about?
So you went for basically, what's the story that I've got on film, not what's the story that I've got on paper?
Right, and not what's the story that I have in my head that I thought was the story that I was telling. Because, you know, I'm a first-time director, and so I didn't get every shot.
Right.
You know, I didn't get the coverage that I wanted. I didn't get all these things in the way that I wanted them to. And, you know, I didn't have Mickey Rourke and Johnny Depp in my movie, and so the acting wasn't always, you know, the important scene that I thought in the script was the most important scene. When it played out with these actors who are not, you know, seasoned actors, right, those scenes were less important. So I rearranged it in a way where it tells a slightly different story in a slightly different order in a slightly different way, and I'm much happier with it.
Right on.
That's cool.
That's very cool.
And it's only been 4.5 years since I shot it, so.
But for a first-time feature, I mean, you know, I mean, I think maybe it's a good thing, you know? Like, it's really hard for someone to get their story on paper and then onto film and then edited and then come out, you know, from one end to the other, the same thing.
It's a change in medium, right? So it's, you know, it's going from a book form, which has a certain pacing to it, to an audiovisual form, which has an entirely different pacing on it. And I imagine a lot of what is in the book is simply not filmic.
I was going to say, I guess I could have said it better, is that, you know, you started with a story on paper and you tried to play it to film, and then there's this break, and then sometime later, a different Kanan comes back who's got much more experience with putting things together, can look at what was done and say, this is how it should be put together, if that makes any better sense.
Right. Or it makes perfect sense. And I would actually add to that and say not just a different Kanan, but a Kanan who hadn't looked at it in a while. And so he wasn't as invested in the story as he started.
Right.
You know, and you're right. The book is completely different. For example, in the book, when Jake meets Andre, he meets him in prison and Andre saves his life. You know, this happens in a prison yard, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have a $65,000 film that I basically funded myself. I'm not shooting a fight scene in a prison yard.
Right.
So you did it on green screen?
No matter how much I want to. Yeah, exactly.
No, he got arrested, so he didn't shoot.
Right. Back then, I didn't really have the chops in 2007 to even know that I could shoot that on green screen. I kind of knew in the back of my head, but not like I do now.
Well, I was going to say, also the technology, while it was available to a certain subset of people, it wasn't as accessible as it is now. The EyeSight camera has it's a really bad Kia, but it's got one, right? So, I mean, the technology is now in the hands of grandmothers. So just being able to have access to all the technology that goes along with it after all these years is obviously a different thing entirely.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, the sort of irony of that is that I shot a short film for a George Romero, I don't know, horror film, short film contest. And there's a ton of green screen in that, because for some reason, putting a monster in the basement made sense on green screen. But for some reason, shooting in a prison yard was just like, just didn't occur to me. I mean, I had the technology, I had the chops, I could have done it. I just, it never occurred to me to do it.
You didn't have the experience per se.
Right. That's it, right? You got to get a lot of scar tissue under your, you know, belt before you can look at something and say, oh, well, you know, rather than climbing to the top of this building and shooting people on top of this building, I could actually shoot them on a green screen, and then it's a hell of a lot easier to composite in the, you know, the top of, you know, let's say New York. And also you don't run, you know, the issue of permits and all these other things that, you know, just like I say, just didn't occur to me.
Before you were doing video production, that you were also doing some application development. You mentioned something about deconstructing TCP/IP packets. When did you get started in application development?
So it's really weird. When I was a kid, I was good with computers. My grandmother was oddly supportive of me, and she bought me my first skateboard and my first computer. And she bought me my first computer when I was extremely young, I guess, probably 10 or 11.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, it was really cool. She wasn't rich. We weren't rich. I mean, the computer was a really big deal at that time for her and for me.
Do you remember what it was? And
I do. So the first computer that I ever owned was a TI-99-4A.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And then she upgraded me to a TRS-80 color computer. I guess it was a Model 2, Model 1.
Nice.
Yeah. And then, of course, I had a friend with a Commodore 64 for a while. And then I had an Apple II at one point. And I had an Apple II because one of my teachers took pity on me because I was seriously poor and let me borrow an Apple II for the entire school year.
Yeah. Just let you borrow it? My goodness.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was great.
Did all the other kids have computers? Was that the deal? Or?
No. It was just we were learning on computers and they had this surplus of computers and they didn't have enough space for all of them and all of, you know, all for students. And she knew that I would get use out of it and trusted me to bring it back. And
wow.
Yeah,
that's really
it was like second grade or something. It was really amazing.
Very cool. So yeah, so I mean, you had the affinity.
I got into it. I did some programming, and then I met this guy. I think he might be in jail now.
Oh dear.
And he, well, it's okay. It's only for coke possession.
Oh well.
I mean, I got in a little bit of trouble when I was younger for making phone calls and doing the kind of things that you do when you're young and you watched war games. And you were good with computers, and nobody had a password, and everything was dial-up, and you could put 150 KB modem on something and be inside the faculty area of a mainframe without a password.
I may or may not be familiar with that.
Right.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I'm just going to say two things, Dragon Slayer BBS and...
Yes.
And modified US robotics.
Right,
may or may not know what you're talking about.
Right. I mean, it was the thing is, if you were in that culture, you were in that culture because there were 17 of us, right?
And we were all so young and so pimply faced.
And so, yeah, it was so ridiculous, but it didn't feel illegal. And I just, for so long, I don't even think it was illegal. I mean, it wasn't until what the Computer Freedom and Privacy Act, I forget the name of the act, but. Yeah, it wasn't until the late 80s where it was even a crime.
Yeah, there was the first, there was the one computer crime law that was basically just, it was kind of the war games law, you know, you broke into something. And then, yeah, it didn't feel illegal because, like you say, I mean, it was like no one was even paying attention. They didn't have any laws to name it. You know.
Well, it's the same thing with, you know, downloading music or what have you illegally. It doesn't feel illegal because you're technically not, you know, you're not stealing a physical object. You know, you're not breaking into a physical building. You just are using a phone line. You're just dialing up a friend.
Right.
You know, it's the same.
Well, and then in that case too, like Kane's alluding to, I mean, it wasn't on anyone's radar to even think about it, you know, that some kid is going to break into your, you know, your computer.
Right. And if I was going to say, if there's no password, is it really breaking in or is it just merely walking in?
It's a very squishy time.
Yes.
Yeah, it was super squishy. And I got really good at getting around systems that I'd never seen before. So I got really good at VAX, for example. And, you know, I was kind of a VMS badass.
Oh, right on.
Then, you know, the Operation Sun Devil happened and suddenly shit got real, right? Steve Jackson Games gets raided. The Legion of Doom gets busted.
Right.
You know, Eric Bloodaxe, we find out his real name is Chris Goggins. You know, the mentor is Lloyd Blankenship. They both work for Steve Jackson Games working on a thing called Cyberpunk. And it's just like the whole thing fucking came apart. And I realized like a lot of the skills that I had needed to be translated into something that could A, earn me a living, and B, would not be illegal. So anyway, I met this guy and this other guy, and three things came out of that. The first thing is that he was doing debt relief for people with credit problems, and he was trying to figure out a way to call a bunch of people and leave messages or have them pass to operators and all that. So I wrote this predictive dialer because that kind of stuff made sense to me. And so it was a bunch of WISE terminals connected to a single system with a dialogic voice card, making phone calls out of some, he basically bought a list of phone numbers of people with bad credit, and he had 24 people just dialing away. And I was 20 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. And as my friend Tom put it one time, he thought I was a drug dealer because he came over and I was getting, you know, I was like, I had a $10,000 check, you know, from a month's work because I had the guy, I had him on a $10,000 a month retainer sure. to keep the system working and every fucking thing about it was custom.
Yeah, but drug dealers don't cut checks.
That's true.
That's the big difference. You know, loads That's of $20 true. Bills around, yeah, then there'd be a problem. Shoeboxes full of cash, sure. Yeah, maybe a problem. Cutting a check,
Exactly. The irony is I feel more like a drug dealer as a color correction person or as an editor because I get paid in cash more often than I did back then as a programmer.
Yeah.
Yeah, was it your last show or something like that you mentioned being at a Starbucks and having some guy just come in with an envelope full of cash and just right. handing it to you?
Well, because I'm basically a scab, right? Because I'm not union and I'm freelance and I don't fall into the books in the way that most people do.
Yeah, that industry gets treated like the McDonald's people, but they get treated like the McDonald's workers of the film industry. And, right. and if McDonald's could pay them under the counter, they sure certainly hell would.
Exactly. And so a lot of it happens that way. So I'll tell you how it went sideways, and then I'll try to keep this as short as possible because it's such a long story. But I met this guy, and Power Rangers were really popular at the time.
Not a sentence I ever thought it would go together.
Well, it's going somewhere.
I believe you.
And I had written a voicemail system for because he had basically, you know, for a while there when Ma Bell got split up, everybody and their mother could come up with a phone company, right? Mm-hmm. So he had his own phone company. And I forget the name of it, Digital Dial or some fucking bullshit like that. But he had his own phone company and he was going to charge people $1.99 a month for a voicemail box or $4.99 or something. And he knew that if he gave voicemail away as part of this long distance phone service that he had, he knew most people would never use it. So I wrote him this voicemail system, you know, and he had tens of thousands of users. And no, I mean, really nobody used it. It was like one little machine with a dialogic card. And anyway, we were sitting around one day and I was like, hey, check this out. And I was hitting some keys and we were listening to DTMF tones, you know.
Like you do.
And I was saying, look at this. If you hit, you know, and I had set it up to where if he typed in his name, it gave him operator access after he entered a password.
Nice.
And we started thinking about DTMF tones. And he goes, hey, man, he goes, I got a question for you. He goes, so those tones, that's when you dial a phone number, that's what happens, right? Like it's just spitting out these tones. And I'm like, yeah, they're called DTMF. And I explained how they work and all that. He goes, okay, so we have this commercial coming up and it's, you know, this is a point in time where 900 numbers were popular. Mm-hmm. And he said, so we have this commercial coming up and I have this idea and we talked about it and I thought, I can do this for you, but you're going to have to pay me a metric fuckload of money and I don't want to be anywhere near it. So here's what we did. He created a commercial that was like somebody dressed as a Power Ranger, absolutely had no rights to the Power Rangers. And then a couple of other Power Rangers come in and the commercial was terrible. It was shot, you know, it was like the worst shot thing that you've ever seen in your entire life. But it was, you know, you can do volume control on commercials, right? So it was like, hey, kids, you like the Power Rangers, right?
Oh, no.
Of course you do. So you want to be a Power Ranger? You want to be an official Power Ranger? Here's what you do. Grab the phone and put it up to the TV.
Oh, no.
No.
Oh, no.
Oh, and so no. The kids, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, would go grab the phone, put it up to the TV, and he aired the shit out of this commercial.
Oh,
and
God.
And they put the phone up to the TV, and it was like, beep, boop, 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 dialed the 900 number.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
And then the Power Ranger on screen was like, you're officially a Power Ranger. Now put the phone down and enjoy the cartoons.
Not hang it up, but put the phone down.
Right. And so this aired in Dallas, Texas, and the surrounding areas for about a week. Made millions of dollars and got to keep about 800,000 of it. I think he took the money and ran.
As well he should.
Anyway, there was a federal investigation about it.
Oh my goodness.
And I didn't shoot the commercial. I didn't, you know, I was just the guy with like, here's how DTMF works.
Right. Okay.
The problem was that had bankrolled the guy that I was working with for the dialing, and the FBI comes in and had a bag of cocaine in his briefcase.
No.
Oops.
Yeah. And so they found everything they could find. You know, they got him for mail fraud because he was, you know, something about sending across state lines. I mean, just every imaginable thing. Anyway, so that got shut down.
Wow.
My cash cow died. And it was complete, you know, happenstance, right? I'd only written a voicemail system for totally legitimate. And I'd written a predictive dialer for totally legitimate. Now that I look back on it, maybe a little bit on the dark side.
Kind of dodgy, maybe. But you're a legitimate businessman. That's what's important.
But a predictive dialer is not in itself an evil thing.
No.
And he's, you know, and it's calling people and trying to help them with their credit. And the guy was, you know, a good salesperson, and it was a lot of money. And I got to program, and I was 20 years old. And
wow.
I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying. No. And the thing that I was most proud of is I wrote a lot of code in C that would detect whether it was a busy signal, an answering machine. I had this really cool way of switching to the Wise terminal where within 3 milliseconds of hearing someone say hello, it would pass them to a person. So the person would almost never hear the word hello, but they knew that the person had said hello. And so they would just say, oh, hello, you know. And it was extremely seamless. I won a bunch of awards. The technology did really well. I think it took first place at a conference 1 year and all this other stuff.
So anyway, what kind of career could this have led to? Let me think. So where did you go from there?
Microsoft.
Dun, dun, dun.
They were not evil in the early 90s. They were
actually, they were fucking evil in the early 90s.
Yeah, they were kind of evil.
I don't think so.
You worked there. You're not allowed to think they were evil then. They gave you a paycheck.
And stock, and set me on my way to starting my own company because I sold some of my Microsoft stock and used that to bankroll a company that I started. I don't have any animosity toward Microsoft in the same way other people do, although they did work me like a fucking dog. And
yeah, I mean, that's...
When I look back on it, what they paid me was complete mouse nuts compared to what I should have been making. But I did get stock, and the stock did go up, and it...
No harm, no foul.
It was not the worst experience I've ever had in my entire life, I assure you.
So that led you into, if I'm not mistaken, security.
Yeah, so I'd always been pretty good at security, as you might have guessed, and I always sort of kept my finger on the pulse of how a lot of things work, and I used to go to something called DEF CON.
Mm-hmm.
I got really interested in this idea of, so at the time there were these technologies, one of which was called a network security scanner, which basically what it did is it scanned hosts to see what vulnerabilities existed in those hosts.
Right.
And there was another technology called an intrusion detection system. And what it did is it detected whether somebody was breaking into you.
Right.
And I decided that those two technologies by themselves were completely stupid, and that the way to make them not stupid was to merge them together so that the network security scanner would see the problems on the network, and the intrusion detection system would discover if somebody was attacking an actual legitimate hole in your network, rather than it being the intrusion detection system being off on its own as an island, you know, being a car alarm, right?
Right.
Anything that looks like an attack, you know, whoop, 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 wah, 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 you know, everything in the world happening. I created this technology called IP360 at a company I started called InCircle, and it was the marriage of a vulnerability assessment or network security scanner and intrusion detection, and it was... You know, the idea that you would see what was on your network and then see if that thing on your network was under attack. And if somebody sent you a random attack that had no legitimate hole on your network, that you would not get an alert. And this doesn't sound groundbreaking until you think about, well, it was 1997, 1998.
Right.
And those types of attacks weren't really, you know, in force then. I mean, sure, some people were doing it, but it wasn't on a global scale like it is today.
Yeah. And, so, you know, so that was good. So I was there for 6 or 7 years, raised a bunch of money. The company's still around. It's sort of weird irony. I'm actually at an office across the street from it right now. And if I go to the front of the building that I'm in, I can look across the street and see the InCircle office.
Oh, wow.
On 2nd Street in San Francisco.
That's got to be weird.
It is really, really weird. Yeah. Oh. I was never in that office. They moved there after because they grew to be, I mean, they're quite big now, and they grew to be quite huge after I left. I mean, we were on a growth path while I was there, but the company was officially started at February 4th of 1998, sorry. And I officially left February 4th of 2003.
So recently, again, that temporal problem that I've got, though, and I guess that we have.
Right. So a year ago.
Yes, exactly. Recently, a year ago, possibly 3 years ago, you decided to create a kane box.
Which kane is the Japanese word for money.
So you had completely altruistic motives then.
Well, it was sort of meant to be ironic, because from the beginning I thought of this as an open source project.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the idea of calling it a money box, and also, you know, Kanan, K-A-N-E, Kane. Anyway, I thought it was funny.
Well, that, and it was designed to be fairly inexpensive to put together as well.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, there's a lot going on about the Kane box, or the Kane box, depending on how you want to call it. The idea behind it was, when I left Encircle, which is the network security company, I started a company called Kozaru. And Kozaru was a natural language-based search engine written in Lisp that was way ahead of its time, was almost exactly like Siri, and was an absolute, abject, complete fucking failure. And it was from 2004 to 2006. Couldn't figure out how to monetize it. The co-founder of Ask Jeeves, this guy David Worthen, bought it at the end of when we essentially ran out of money after 2 years of trying to figure out a way to monetize it. It's like if we were flying along in a Cessna, when he took it over, he decided that if you push really hard forward on the sticks and aim the Cessna exactly vertically at the ground and put as much power behind it as you can so that you descend not slowly but as rapidly as possible into the ground, that would be the thing to do with the Kozaru technology.
Okay.
But the lesson I learned there was, because it was written in Lisp and it was mostly statistical based and it was functional. I mean, there was a product called Biomes. We got a lot of press about, we were in Business 2.0 and TechCrunch wrote about us, and we were at the Web 2.0 conference and all this stuff. Technically, it wasn't a failure, but from a business perspective, it was a complete abject failure. The thing I learned, though, was that you could write something in Lisp and use statistics to solve a problem that's not normally something you would think of a statistical problem. And so I thought, I wonder if I can do that with network security. I wonder if instead of having people write rules and create signatures and do all of this crap, I wonder if I could just create something that where you train, you know, you capture packets from an attack and you train the system. Hey, this is what an attack looks like. You know, in the same way Google trained spam filtering through Bayesian statistics. Mm-hmm. If you could train a system on what is good and what is bad, I wonder if you could just let it run and if it would be super fast and just stopping attacks, you know, or viruses or whatever you trained it on. And that's what KaneBox was, is it was a small statistical engine written in Lisp to do that.
It would effectively write its own rules based upon those statistics and take action. So it merged statistical analysis.
You had to train it at first.
Oh, I see.
As you let it run to see what normal looked like, and then you trained it on captured attacks or captured viruses or captured malware or captured whatever from the internet.
So put it on the front end and let it see everything, but continue to do what you do on the back end.
Right. Mm. And so the idea was that if you take, because you can freely download packet captures of attacks and viruses and malware and all that stuff. You can freely download that off the internet.
I didn't actually realize that one would save that so that others could download it.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, the virus is short.
Openpacket.org is a great example of the entire transaction where somebody sends an attack, the attack happens, the entire packet capture end-to-end of attacks and categorized by attack type and all that.
Wow. Okay, now I've got to do a lot of investigation on that.
Sure.
So
I downloaded that and created a way to push that through the statistical engine so that the engine would learn about the statistics behind that attack. You know, I did all this coding like in coffee shops, and Eric Harnden actually donated a Asus EPC to me when I was in Panama City because I was tired of working out of coffee shops. And so he sent me an Asus EPC. Or actually, I think he PayPal'd me the money to buy an Asus EPC for, I don't know, it was like $218 or something, $280. I bought it. It had a Spanish keyboard.
Oh.
It was preloaded with Windows, and it already had a virus.
Right on.
Nice.
Perfect.
Which is fine, because the first thing I did, of course, was blast Windows and put Linux on it. And then the second thing I did when I got back to the US is purchase from Asus a English, American English keyboard, because the Spanish keyboard was confusing to do anything on, except, well, I was writing code, so it was not that hard, but still, it was bizarre.
Remapping the keyboard. What would you need that for, perhaps? Emacs and someone who loves Lisp.
Right.
Yeah. I listened to your Mary Rose Cook episode, and you guys gave a little love letter to Lisp. You really love Lisp, I gather.
I really love Lisp. But actually, that's a little bit of a lie. I really, 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 really love Lisp. I really, 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 really hate the people who are Lisp people. Because so Lisp, if anyone doesn't know, Lisp is a functional. Well, so Lisp is a complicated thing because it's a programming language. It's one of the first programming.
It's a lifestyle languages. Choice.
It's an elaboration of the lambda calculus. So it's a reducible language where everything is nested in parentheses, just like maths. What happens is it kind of works in the way that you think of, when you go back and you think about your mathematics class where you put things in parentheses and they get evaluated in a certain way. So it works sort of like that in the way that the lambda calculus would work. You should definitely look it up.
Right.
Because it's a really, really super, super interesting language. It's Turing complete. It has everything that, for the kind of work that I was doing, it was fucking exactly what I needed. But Lisp in general, like common Lisp and all that, it's like Gulliver's Travels, where the Lilliputians are fucking fighting over which end of the egg to crack first, And it's ridiculous. I mean, people argue over the most asinine things that you could ever imagine arguing over. And if you don't believe me, go look at comp.lang.lisp or on Google Groups, and
that,
look
that
at
that would actually be Usenet for the
7,000 fucking pages of arguments over whether or not something should be C-A-R or C-A-A-R when it's in a certain context, when it's used. And it's ridiculous, right?
For those not willing to look, it's kind of like going and reading YouTube comments or going to Reddit for anything, just arguments.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Or I would describe it as /dot with an IQ above 40.
But below 90.
That's right, /dot. I just insulted you. And so this episode is about winning friends and influencing people.
Oh, sure.
That's what this is about. The idea behind the Kanban box was I wanted to create a small statistical engine that would run in a firmware, so it could run on a router or something like that. And to be clear, it works. I'm actually speaking through one to you right now.
Cool.
The thing that I haven't had an opportunity to do, because I'm, well, did I mention that my film is 4.5 years late?
Yes.
Briefly.
So the thing I haven't had to do is I haven't had a chance to open source everything in the way that I've wanted to. And then in the meantime, there were a series of modules. So the version of Lisp that I program in, which if you're a Lisp person, you're going to say that I'm a son of a bitch and this isn't really Lisp, but you'd be wrong. The version of Lisp that I program in is a version of Lisp called New Lisp. And New Lisp is beautiful because it has modern conventions like, built-in TCP/IP stack.
Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of things that are just for the modern age, very,
right.
internet/HTML, HTTP-centric.
Right. Like you could actually do get URL and get the contents of a URL instead of fucking coloned machinations of libraries of crap that you have to install. So anyway, New Lisp, awesome, which I love deeply and profoundly. And the guy who created it is a guy named Lutz Mueller. And Lutz Mueller is actually, he and I have been friends for a while. He actually worked at Koseru. We discovered the language then, hired the guy. And I said, okay, your job in life is to get paid to make this better so we can use it more.
Right on.
Right.
Yeah.
The world thanks you.
Yeah. So New Lisp is pretty awesome, mostly as a result of a ton of smart people at Koseru and a ton of smart people in the Lisp community, and hopefully a little bit because I actually helped the guy make it better.
Well,
I continued to do that when I was working on Kanibox, right? All of the TCP/IP subsystem that does packet construction and all the TCP/IP subsystem that does the basically libpcap stuff where you can listen in on a Berkeley packet filter interface and see streaming packets come in. I provided all the example code to Lutz to add that into the language.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and when I skank you, I didn't mean for creating new lists, but for any company who takes the time to say, let's make something better for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it was completely selfish because we wanted New Lisp to be better, but
that's the best way to do it, though.
Right. We certainly saw the benefits to both the language and to the language, hopefully the language's growth, because I think it's a phenomenal language. Mm-hmm. The problem with it is, did I mention it's Lisp?
I think
and
you did.
So there's like 14 people on the planet who are as big a fan of Lisp as I am. Everything kind of changed in a way. You thought it was going to be Perl and Python and Ruby and scripting, and it kind of is, except have you seen the market cap of Apple lately?
Yeah, everything's suddenly going Objective-C and
And Objective-C is weird, right? Because it's like close to the metal, as they would say, and it's also object-oriented in a way that is really bizarre. The syntax is, I mean, you think parentheses are confusing. If you've tried to program in Objective-C, the syntax is, well, let me just say, in order to create a string, I have to invoke something called NSString. NSString is a string that has NS in front of it because it is both, what is it, a class, and NS stands for next step?
For next step, yes.
Fuck me. Well, like,
that's because all the classes that they created in Cocoa are NS whatever, which is, I mean, it's a convention. So if you're creating that, if you're creating that class, then you've got, you know, you're going to use your own. I think Apple has said that you're not supposed to use two-letter extensions. You have to use three or more letters. But a lot of people do that. You know, if they create something, it's, you know, CMH string. It's a lot of camel case. It's a huge number of square brackets and parentheses. Aside from that, it's not a horrible language. It's just very, just very difficult, and it doesn't read very well because it uses a lot of characters that aren't letters or numbers.
Yeah, except compared to New Lisp and the use and the way that New Lisp works and how easy it is to write the kind of code that I like writing and stuff. What is that cat of nine tails? Is that what it's called? So it's like being sodomized by a cat of nine tails connected to a fucking machine.
Right. And what you're getting
I've
at
seen that at Folsom East.
I usually pay extra for it, but go ahead.
And what you're getting at, though, is that we all thought that it was going to evolve more and more, you know, to leave the programmer to worry about the high concept, and it doesn't seem to really be heading that way.
No, and it can't, because what's happened is the cost of processors, you know, we've sort of raced to the minimum amount of processing and the minimum amount of RAM and the minimum, you know, bits and all that, and we're all mobile, right? And so we're all carrying around these, I mean,
it will reset.
Okay, it's a 1 gigahertz, you know, dual processor ARM chip. But that's, I mean, honestly, right? That's like saying I have the fanciest hut in this third world country.
But that's just it. You know, computing, you know, when the Apple II came out, everything was done in assembler because you needed all the bits. But as processors became faster and faster and RAM became, you know, more viable and people had more RAM and more hard drive space, the languages became more abstract because you could do more with it. You had more room to play. And it was really great because these abstract languages made programming less error-prone, but they required more resources. And so consequently, people who were learning to program recently, within the last decade or so, they are cutting their teeth on Java, you know, versus cutting their teeth on C or Lisp or Smalltalk, for example, which are fairly abstract, fairly straightforward languages to learn. But with mobile, now everything is sort of back to square one, where we are now super constrained. We have to deal with things like battery life. We have to deal with things like very slow processors in comparison to what we used to, you know, these multi-gigahertz things that are doing millions of instructions per second and a very, very, very small RAM footprint.
Oh, it's like it's been a constant sort of thing we've talked about on this show, is that because we, you know, the idea was always that we are building towards, you know, the computer, the desktop, the laptop, but that's not where the world's going. You know, we're going to this mobile space. And of course, that means batteries and yada, yada, yada. But when I was back with Intel, you know, we were building for this. We called it the software spiral, which was the requirement for more and more resources on the end user's machine to handle exactly what you're talking about. So they need more power and more RAM and so forth, because these programs are growing so, well, the programming is growing abstract. The programs grow larger and require more resources because, you know, so much less is being done on the front end. So, yeah, we're moving into a space where the mobile device is becoming the device. We've said this several times already, but, you know, in a few years, it's going to be a very different landscape.
Right. And it'll change again, right? So we'll right now we're roughly at, actually, Maggie, you sent out that page that had the MIPS equivalents to all the computers in the last 50 years or so. Right. And the iPad is roughly equivalent to what, a dual processor 1.2 gigahertz G4?
I don't remember exactly, but it was something like that, yeah.
Yeah. So, and, you know, it's funny because the iPad 2, it's small, it's lightweight, it's got about, you know, 10 to 12 hours worth of battery life in it, and it's capable of all this stuff that required a giant desktop system, what, 5-6 years ago. Actually, more than that, I suppose. You know, in a couple of generations, we're going to get to a place where RAM matters less. Where, right. You know, the...
Well, and that was sort of the point that I'm making, is it's like you're processor constrained, but you're also RAM constrained. And of course, you know, the amount of storage is actually, you know, it's gotten a little bit better, but man, the amount of RAM in your iPad is laughable.
Oh yeah, it's 512 megabytes of RAM.
I mean, it's totally ridiculous, right? So you have to write something in this language that is, you know, as the nerds say, right, close to the metal, which is really bizarre, because you... Certainly, if you'd asked me 10 years ago if I thought the number one programming language on the fucking planet was going to be Objective-C,
well,
I would have thought that there was absolutely no way.
Well, there's also, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but it's also a little bit different in the case of Apple, because yes, they're programming in Objective-C technically, but what they're really doing is they're really using the Cocoa frameworks or the Touch frameworks. And so... they're not as close to the metal as you'd think.
Oh, I would actually totally disagree with that and say what they're really doing is that they're using C because it is close to the metal and that's why it's so fast. And they've jammed on top of it the ability to program to Cocoa or Touch.
Well, I mean, Objective-C is a superset of C. I mean, I don't necessarily think that a superset... And actually, it's a fairly good superset as well.
Right. Well, would you say C++ is... Because I just think C++ is C with classes.
Oh, no.
Objective-C is C with classes.
No. C++ is basically an entirely different animal. It is not merely a superset of C. It's a very different beast. Whereas Objective-C is really just a superset. It's C with some extra stuff on it. Right. As a matter of fact, you can program in straight C in Objective-C if you wanted to without anything scary. Whereas
no, I know I have. Well, I wrote a program called HD Speed Test.
Oh, that's
and the
right.
only thing in HD Speed Test that, you know, does anything with Objective-C is the interface, which is marginally crappy at best, and the because, you know,
I was going to say
that's not my wheelhouse.
As, you know? As an interface designer, I actually considered changing that for you.
Actually, it's funny you mention that because I was and we'll, so the, real quick, the other thing that's written in Objective-C is the part that pushes it through the core video, through the QuickTime, through, you know, the grabs the files off the disk. And I don't know if you've opened up the HD speed test, but if you look in the resources folder, there's actually a frame of video of each of the video sizes.
Oh right, okay.
And what it does is it generates, it changes that frame and it moves pixels around so that it actually pushes it through in the same way that Final Cut or Avid or any of these others would push it through. So you're not just copying a fucking file like you do with these other things. So I was at the Macworld.
Yes.
And
yes.
And one of the vendors there was Western Digital, and they were showing off this new Western Digital Thunderbolt drive system that they have, which is really cool. You pop the top, you can pop the drives out, you can daisy chain them into RAID. I mean, they were getting 700 or 800, you know, megabytes a second throughput.
Of just raw throughput.
Of several of these chained together. But they were using the Blackmagic speed test to do it. And, you know, it's got that nice, like, somewhat sexual curve of a woman breast sticking out gauge thing going on. If you've never seen it, take a look at it. It is, I swear to God, it's designed to be attractive to me.
I have that and I've never noticed that.
Yeah.
That explains a lot, really.
Do we really need to go down that road?
Oh, I've gone down that road.
So I was looking at it and they were showing it to me and all I could think to myself is like, fuck this tool. It's irritating. I need to update my speed test because, you know, now with core video and core animation and all of these different, you know, things going on in Lion and, you know, 64-bit, I like literally want to rewrite it because I want to re-release HD speed test as a tool that legitimately tells you the speed in which your computer can process video, not the speed in which your computer can drag a file from one location to another.
Yeah, and that was you came up with that at a very opportune time. Well, you and I were talking at the time because I was doing a lot of drive testing then and, you know, using the Asia tool and using the Blackmagic tool and there's, you know, and they're getting so much, you know, different results. I share your frustration or shared, whatever.
Right. So you're actually listed as, if you go into HD speed test and you pull up the information panel, you're listed as the first or second person in the special thanks to the awesome people who helped me make this tool great. Aww. I think you and John Foster are in the top two in that list. because you guys both provided so much feedback, and you guys, I think we're both people who are like, I really want to know, like, I'm going to put this tool through its paces and make sure it's not totally crappy and make sure it actually is legitimate.
Yeah, I was giving people numbers, so I wanted to not give them numbers that sucked or were wrong.
And if you recall, the numbers you were getting from HD speed test were pretty different than the numbers you were getting from the AJA or the Blackmagic tools.
Right.
Yeah. So to clarify for the listeners, most of these speed test tools, what they do is basically a random copy or an ordered copy of a file. It doesn't actually go through a normal like QuickTime pipeline. It's a synthetic test. And so it's going to give you a number that's much larger than the number that you're going to get if you're actually doing real work. So,
And it doesn't push it through the video card, which is honestly, that's a big part of it.
Yeah, that is a big deal, especially for, for the video. I mean, for people doing video. I know that sounds like a tautology, but what I mean is people, doing, video editing or visual effects or things like that or anything where, it's a huge difference. It's absolutely visible from one test to the other.
And usually it's the video folk who are thrashing the disc most often these days. Video people, 3D people, hitting swap space, that's one thing. And that's more, just a straight file copy. If you do have a video pipeline, you really do need to have all those frames going on through the entire pipeline to really understand, what your throughput's going to be and what your bottleneck really will wind up being.
And so let's imagine for just a second that you're doing 1K copies. You're doing an ordered copy and it's 1K chunks. And for every 1K chunk that you're doing, you're suffering an 8 to 12% difference in the speed compared to the speed that you would have if you were actually running through the full video pipeline, right? So now let's say, for example, you do that on a 1 gigabyte file. The numbers become ridiculous, right? The actual numbers are so far off at the end of it that it's unimaginable that they're calling this a video speed test. I mean, they should really be punched in the face for calling it a video speed test.
It's very self-referential, here's the speed at which it does the thing that this speed test does, and then everyone gets used to the speed test. Well, compared
but they're
to
calling
the,
it a video speed test, Maggie. That's my point.
No, I don't disagree. That's what I mean. I mean, the way that people ended up using it is like, if you're going to make comparisons, you ended up making comparisons with other speed tests of the same nature with the same tool. It's like, well, that doesn't actually tell you what your speed is. And this was all happening right around the time that, the RED cameras were really saturating the market. So everyone was interested in speed. Everyone was building, these people that had never before really needed or large RAID systems suddenly needed them. And a lot of them were independent people instead of companies, So this was very interesting to them, to get the most speed and to build up these systems that they can't use with Final Cut Pro 10 now. But anyway, I won't go there.
But the thing that's funny about that is what I was noticing, because I had a lot of clients building RAIDs and we were doing a lot of pretty heavy duty work at the time. What I was noticing is that people were building these $10,000, $15,000 RAIDs.
Oh, yeah. That's
multi-terabyte, massive amount of storage, hot swappable, expensive ass RAIDs, right? And then what was happening is that they weren't actually getting real-time performance on these 2K images.
Right.
Even though the speed tests were like, you could totally do 5 simultaneous streams of 2K.
Guess what? You'll be good. You'll be happy if you get 2 out of this, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, many times you'll be happy if you get 1, because it's more than just a problem with the video card and a problem with the disk. You're also talking about, like, you have an application that has to push it through, Core Video, QuickTime. It has to push it through the video card. It has to read it off disk. It has to write it back into, it has to go through memory. It has to do all these different things. And that also, by the way, that system, like Final Cut Pro, is only using one processor.
Right.
And so there's a million different reasons why the numbers are total bullshit.
It's like looking at your times for a quarter mile race versus around the track, A quarter mile race is going to be one thing for different cars, but going around the track is what you need to do. And that's really the number you want to see.
Right. This car can do 0 to 60 in 4.2 seconds. Therefore, it can win the Indy 500.
Right.
No.
So I think we're running a little bit long, but we've got a lot more to cover. So I'm actually officially inviting you back next time.
Oh, I'd be happy to be back on.
Cool.
I mean, this is great. I mean, I had this laundry list. The problem is I need to stop doing so many things so poorly and learn to speak about them more quickly.
That's what editing is for. We'll figure it all out. So, Kanan, where can we find you?
Well, you can find me on the Twitters, but the best way to find me is to go to scruffythinking.com, and then there are links to the podcast, there are links to me on Twitter, there's links, I think, I'm trying to remember if there's a link to scruffy.tv from there. I believe there is, which is a lot of the post work that I do.
Maggie, where can we find you?
You can find me on the Twitters as well, T-A-N-K-G-R-R-L. Or you can also find me at about.me/Maggie McPhee. That'll get you where you need to go. What about you, sir? Where can we find you, Christopher?
Right on. These days you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Octothorpe. And you can also find me at ruiningitforeveryone.tv. Kanan, thank you very much for coming on board. And we'll continue this conversation another week.
Excellent. Looking forward to it.
Cheers.
That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show as it really helps us out.
Oh my god. This just gets progressively worse.
Oh, yeah. It's murder.
Every time we say anything.
It's murder house two.
It's murder house two.